tonight, the subject matter is pressure points, retaliation. The pressure to retaliate, which is, I don't know if that's a problem for anybody other than me, but to retaliate tends to be an interesting problem. Yeah, I know, especially for those that don't know how to drive. And I really got that road rage because, I mean, when I get in the car, I want to get where I'm going and get out. Because when I drove teaching and recruiting seminary students for Gardner Webb in, 3 years, I put close to 170,000 miles on school vehicles. And that was just traveling for the school. That wasn't other stuff. So I wanted to get places and get out. But retaliation comes, though, in all kinds of other ways and all kinds of other situations. So the opening question is, what makes you want to get even with somebody?
Sometimes you think you're God's implement doing His will. Vengeance is the Lord, and you're doing it for Him, or something like that. At least that's a rationalization.
Well, I mean, somebody does something to hurt you. Al said, other than feeling good, and then Ed with, you feel like, vengeance is mine, I will repay, thus says the Lord. But the Sadducees sometimes thought that they were God's instrument to repay and to keep the poor poor and to make money. Some of the Sadducees, for example, they would, they wanted to keep their money and everything. They didn't mind if the Romans ran roughshod as long as the Romans let them keep doing what they wanted to do. And the Sadducees felt that you got all rewards and punishments in this life, not in the afterlife. So if you were wealthy, had power, and had position in this life, that meant God was rewarding you. And if you were poor, oppressed, diseased, then God was punishing you. And if a Sadducee happened to be a loan shark, he would consider, and somebody said, well, wait a minute, you're preying off the poor. That's all right. God's allowing me to be His instrument to punish this other person. Yeah, that kind of thing. But there are a lot of people in the world who feel that way. And not just within militant Muslim segments of the world. There are those folks who think they are God's instrument of retaliation and wrath, etc. But there are Christians who have felt the same way over the centuries, and others as well. Some of the things, cut off in traffic, or for Matt, being cut off at the staircase so that he falls. Yeah. Maybe being bullied by somebody or pushed around by somebody. The thing that comes to my mind is that movie that runs for 24 hours right before Christmas with Peter Billingsley, A Christmas Story, where you shoot your eye out, kid, but where he ends up beating up the bully. Of course, my favorite scene in the whole thing is when his brother, because I can understand, when his brother's like, and he falls over and he can't get up. It's because his mom has put so many clothes on him, he can't roll up out of the snow. But being bullied. Maybe being done wrong by a friend. Or a neighbor. Or a boss. Or a co-worker. Being done wrong by a family member. Being spiked when you're covering second base by somebody that you got him dead to rights, and he gets this far away and jumps in the air cleats first. One of my teammates got to him before I could. He cut me there and down, and he was third baseman for the other team. And when if I came around third base, even if I didn't have to slide, I was going to slide and cut him to shreds. Yeah. So, all kinds of things that we do. Or even little things that we perceive, a misplaced word or a look that might cause us to want to get even or retaliate. Why? Because we've been hurt or we feel we've been wronged in some way or another. But, it's natural. It's natural to want to retaliate. It doesn't please God if we do. And sometimes it can lead to worse things. But it's natural for us to want to retaliate. Is it not? We did retaliate after 9/11. We retaliated on a number of other occasions. But that was one of those where it was you didn't find very many people in the world, in the United States, that said we shouldn't retaliate. And I think it was, we had been struck, we had been hurt, our sense of safety, you know, because we weren't like Israel that's always got folks trying to kill them. You know, our sense of safety was suddenly gone, and what made it worse was they didn't strike military targets. They struck civilian targets, and most of the folks killed were civilian. But, you know, God doesn't necessarily mean or doesn't intend for us to merely be a doormat, though, either. God doesn't intend for us to totally ignore justice for the oppressed or to put ourselves always in harm's way. As the writer of your book, if you've read in there, you may find has said that basically we're to trust in God's justice and judgment, because God will do a better job than us, and we need to be patient, to take time and strengthen our hearts, waiting on God to act. In fact, James says we're to be slow to anger. Now, that doesn't mean we repress appropriate indignation. I miss my foil tonight. So if you're listening to this, either live or in Memorex, I would say, and you know who I'm speaking of, I would say, Susan, it doesn't mean that we repress appropriate indignation, because Jesus himself showed righteous indignation on more than one occasion. But he didn't allow his anger to get the best of him in the long run. And while there are times where we need to show that kind of indignation, it's how we do it and not allowing it to gain control over us, not ending up in a rut where we're always angry. Doing some premarital counseling this afternoon. One of our church members' daughter, one of his daughters, is getting married in the spring, so I was doing some premarital counseling there. And we were chatting, and I asked them, you know, talked about marriage and everything, getting stuck in a rut. I said, you know what a rut is? I said, no, I said, a rut's nothing but a grave with both ends knocked out. Because we can get stuck in a rut to the point that everything dies, and we just keep going along in that death march. And sometimes we can let that anger get to the point, and that indignation get to the point where we get stuck in the rut. And while physically it may not kill us, although we know what stress can do, physically it may not kill us, it kills relationships and other things along the way. But that anger, that sense of I've been wronged and I need to do something to strike back, is a natural kind of thing. James is writing here in chapter 5, the first part of chapter 5, to both groups, once again, the rich and famous, the rich and the powerful, the well-placed, and those who are oppressed, poor, feel a lack of justice. And he uses here, he's writing to the rich and the well-placed among the believers, challenging them to leave behind their corrupt behavior, their oppressive behavior. But he's also writing to the oppressed to be patient, to endure, and not to follow the example of the rich and famous, who will find ruin. In fact, they are examples of, in his mind, the folly of going after nothing but wealth and fame. It's interesting that over the years in teaching world religions, that in one of the other world religions that happens to be very popular out there, in Buddhism and in Hinduism, you can choose the way of pleasure if you want to in your life. But you will find that the way of pleasure will not ultimately satisfy, and it will dissatisfy you. You can choose the way of wealth, but you'll find that eventually wealth will not satisfy, that is, satisfy what's inside you. Or you can choose the way of devotion, religious devotion. And so James is kind of putting this out here as well. The folly of accumulating wealth, especially at the expense of others, or accumulating power, especially at the expense of others. When you do that, though, then his letter points to those who are being oppressed or who feel that they've been taken advantage of, wanting them not to be envious, but also not to retaliate in inappropriate ways, to fight that human nature that we tend to have. Come now, you rich people, weep and wail for the miseries that are coming to you. Your riches have rotted and your clothes are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have rusted and their rust will be evidence against you, and it will eat your flesh like fire. You've laid up treasure for the last days. Listen, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out, and the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You've lived on the earth in luxury and in pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the righteous one who does not resist you. Here, James invites the rich, the famous, those who are in places of power, to pause for a moment and to think about how they've gotten there and what it's done to other people. Other people and relationships with those people, but ultimately what it does in their relationship with God. You know, there are times when we want to retaliate, but there are times when we have the upper hand too. So it serves as a warning when we have the upper hand. We may not be the rich and famous, but we have the upper hand to be careful about our attitude toward those over whom we have that control or against whom we have the upper hand. And he's writing here to call upon them to think about what they have done and the judgment that will come upon them. The judgment that comes upon us if we take advantage of others, but also it's a warning again to the ones who are being oppressed not to retaliate and become like those oppressors, because they too will find the same outcome if they do that. So it's a limit to retaliation. And by the way, you've heard it said, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, limb for limb, stripe for stripe, life for life. Actually, in the Old Testament, that was a limit to vengeance, to retaliation. The most you could do if someone put out your eye was to put out their eye. The most you could do if someone cut off your arm was to cut off their arm. It wasn't a formula. That was the most you could do. It was a limit to retaliation. And even there were limits. Person cuts off your arm, you have the right, if you wish to have their arm cut off, but they're already missing one arm. You still have one with which to work. That puts them at an extreme disadvantage, and so restitution comes about. They have to pay you for the arm they cut off. A limit to vengeance. A limit to retaliation. So it's not just James, but even in the Hebrew Scriptures, we have this push in regulations from God to be careful, to think about whether we retaliate or not, and if so, what are the limits to that? And why? And so he's talking here for them to weep and wail. Literally, the word means to howl in great anguish. It's a pronouncement of judgment for the benefit of the poor and the oppressed. While it might contain a call to repent, which is implied, it is more of a grim statement of judgment against them. A grim statement of judgment. And goes back kind of as a critique of the presumptions of the powerful. If you look at chapter 4, verses 13 through 17, he says, these powerful ones say, come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we'll go to such and such a town, spend a year there doing business, making money. Yet you do not even know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wishes, we will live and do this or that. As it is, though, you boast in your arrogance. And all such boasting is evil. And so he's saying you need to watch your attitude always about why. And the description of the judgment on these hoarded riches is not just a statement against the oppressors, the money grabbers. It's a warning for the poor and the oppressed not to envy them and not to adopt what Christopher Church says, not to adopt the world's values and unjust means of attaining them. End of quote. Your riches have rotted. Your clothes are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have rusted, and their rust will be evidence against you. All that hoarding of this and oppressing others to do it. He said, you know, it's going to be evidence against you. And by the way, when someone oppresses you, you need to think in your sense of wanting to retaliate about what their oppression has gotten them. In the end, it gets them pain and judgment and punishment, even beyond what the riches can salve. These rich, and by the way, he's speaking about the rich in the church. He's speaking about the powerful in the church. He's not talking about the folks that are outside the church. He's talking about those who have abused their sense of power and position within the church and have refused to help others. In fact, some within the church that have used it. Now, I know we don't have that problem today. 21st century. We don't have folks who are in churches that abuse their places of power, their money, or that kind of stuff. I mean, last century, I do know, you know, there was a church, well, it still exists in northern Greenville County, and the carpet and the cushions on the pews are crushed Clemson orange because the money man in the church wanted it that way. And he said, I give the money, I pay for these things, it will be this color. No, it didn't have tiger paws on it. And actually, this is a true story. They had a minister who was a really nice guy and really good fellow. They had a minister who happened to be, he strutted Columbia. He happened to be a Gamecock. And do what? Well, he... Yeah, he was a good fella anyway, Junior. But he actually had a run-in with that guy one time over another issue, and in his demise, the person who had all the money and who had all of this done to the carpet, etc., I heard it myself, made the comment that what could you expect from someone like that? And he was serious. He wasn't joking. So you know, that was last century. I know we don't have people in churches today that wield that kind of power. And yeah, they do out there all the time in different places. But, you know, these rich in the church have pursued wealth by any means necessary. And that's what he's talking about. They have even oppressed people in the church to get their wealth. Even by fraud. By abuses in the court system. And he says here, ironically, the crops that they have hoarded, the fine clothes they have gotten, the precious metals they have become worthless to them. You know, they think they've got all of this, but in the long run, they're worthless. When they stand before God, they're worthless. And what he gives here when he talks about eating your flesh and you've laid up treasures and it'll come against you like fire. And then, listen, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields and you kept back from fraud cry out. He's actually going back to covenant lawsuits that are spoken by the prophets and others within Judaism, including Leviticus 19 and Deuteronomy 24. The stolen wages shout for justice like Abel's blood and will stand as evidence against them before the judge. While they themselves judge, it will be evidence. By the way, the Torah required that you paid laborers before sunset of the day they worked. If someone worked a full day for you, you were to pay them before sunset for that day's work. They literally did live from, in many ways, from paycheck to paycheck, from day to day. And if you didn't pay their wages but held them back, they may not be able to buy food for their families for that night or even for the next day. Or provide other things for families. And so the Torah actually required that payment at the end of the day for that day's wages so that they could feed their families. They could pay their bills. They could provide a place to live. And if they were not paid, basically you were starving them, oppressing them even more. In verse 4, when it says, listen, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out, and the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts, The Greek word for cry here is the cry of a starving and injured animal. It's the cry of a starving and injured or wounded animal. You ever heard an animal who was wounded, that gut-wrenching, deep-down cry? Well, you probably could with cell phones like they are. Yeah. But interestingly enough, it's the same word, same Greek word used in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures, the same word used when it says, when God says, the cries of my people have reached me and I have heard them in Egypt. It's the same word that is used, that in Egypt they were so oppressed. He said, you know, the cries of my people have finally reached me and I've heard them. It's the same word, that almost mournful death cry. I think you're right,
even more,
Connie.
So than being hurt ourselves, I've been through the experience of somebody that I dearly love being wounded, you know, to his death, but you know that he died, and that there was a person, you know, that I wanted to place some blame, and I know how anguished I was at that
right.
time, and that I went through this period of wanting retaliation. And I, you know,
right.
talk about this, I remember that anguish that you feel, and is that part of how we cope with that? If
well,
I think you're correct.
I think that sometimes it's not that we have been hurt, but it's the anguish we feel because someone else about whom we care has been hurt so deeply. You know, I mean, I have admitted, and I still sometimes have to think about it. You know, hurt me is one thing, but hurt my family. And there is still a person in South Carolina that I would probably hesitate for a moment if they stepped off the curb. Okay, do I hit the brake or the gas? Because of the way they hurt my family. At one point in time, I had our 86 Toyota Camry. Before they went to the little elliptical with the symbol in there, it was like this with a T in the middle, so it looked like crosshairs. And I thought, but it wasn't so much that they hurt me, but the anguish they caused family.
And
I, right. Well, I think so. Right. And I do think that since maybe that sense of retaliation gets ramped up more when it is a cry of anguish because of some family member that has been hurt or some friend that has been hurt so deeply, more so than when we ourselves feel that sting or that pain. And those are difficult things to get over, obviously, because I brought it up again. You know, they're difficult things. I work on that regularly, trying to get over some of that. And sometimes I think, okay, I've forgiven, and then something will happen. I'll remember it, and I'm just, you know.
I think when this experience happened to me, I think the Lord intervened. My pastor's wife called me that morning, just out of the blue. I was
right.
sitting alone with very dark thoughts, and she called me and said, you know, what's going on? Almost like she knew something.
Right, right.
You know, and by being able to talk to her, she kind of, you know,
absolutely.
From that mindset.
Yeah, absolutely. And that gave an opportunity for someone to help move you, but also for you to kind of talk through some things that were internalized and in a safe way.
That's a dark place to be.
Oh, it is.
It's a dark place.
It is. And retaliation, and in your thought at that point in time, retaliation would taste very sweet, you would think. That's what you think, right? What is the line out of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan? Revenge is a dish best served cold. where Ricardo Montalban is referring to James T. Kirk. And so I do think so. It's that anguished cry, and it's the same cry that was coming from the slaves in Egypt. you know, that God hurt. Christopher Church writes, what James is saying is that the injustice has reduced the working poor to the state of wounded and dying animals. That's how they feel. It's taken them that low. But that God hears their cry for justice. Just as God heard the cry for justice, and it took a while. You know, sometimes I imagine being one of those Hebrews, and Moses says, yeah, God's finally heard you cry, and he's going to bring you out. Well, it's about time. Yeah. It's been going on so long. It's about time. But even though it may take a while, that story and so many stories in the biblical text, and James here says in verse 7, be patient, beloved, until the coming of the Lord. You know, God heard and he took care of it before, so be patient and God will hear the cry for injustice, will understand your struggle, and God's promise has been to deliver you from exile, to stand on your behalf. Although sometimes we get in those places and we don't feel like God's standing up on our behalf, do we? And that's when we really want to reach out and touch. And not just reach out and touch somebody's hand. We want to reach out and touch them in a more meaningful way. Right? And maybe some of y'all have never been there, but it's a hard place to be. New Testament theologian Elsa Tamez writes, and I quote, "We should dialogue with God in situations of oppression and violence, pain and abandonment. Moments of prayer strengthen the spirit and inspire the practice of liberation, but prayer also foresees moments of fullness in which we can feel the grace of God and experience joy in spite of the pain and abandonment." End of quote. And so he's saying, you know, you who have lived on the earth in this luxury and pleasure and oppressed other people, don't think that just because they haven't retaliated against you in grand ways that you're getting off the hook. The retaliation will come from God. You have condemned yourselves and murdered the righteous one who does not resist you. And here it's not talking about murdering Jesus, the righteous one. It's talking about murdering that person you've oppressed. You've murdered their spirit. And God will act on their behalf. And as I was saying in that premarital counseling session earlier today when we were talking about all kinds and talking about how to do this and how to work at that, and I said, now, I want to tell you right now, this is a whole heck of a lot easier to say than it is to do. Especially in marriage. It's a whole lot easier to say than to do. But it's the same thing here. Talking about not retaliating and not adopting the methods of the oppressors is a whole lot easier to say than it is to do. James then expects the intervention of God, though, here in verses 7 and following. Be patient, therefore, beloved, until the coming of the Lord. The farmer waits for the precious crop from the earth, being patient with it until it receives the early and the late rains. You must also be patient. Strengthen your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is near. That's tough. James calls for patience. You know, he had said that judgment, in James chapter 2, verse 13, he had said, judgment will be without mercy to anyone who shows no mercy. And so he's calling to be patient. Wait on God. Let God take care of this. But then just as soon as we think God's turned his back, we're ready to do it, right? And in chapter 4, verse 6, he says, God resists the proud and gives grace to the lowly. And so he's calling the poor and the oppressed to a courageous persistence. But that's a whole lot easier said than done. But his call for patience here is not do nothing. Sit back and do nothing. In fact, he uses the farmer as an example of patience, but patience that does something. That seeks to do something on the positive side. It's a command to be steadfast and alert, ready for what God has in store. There will be a judgment for tormentors, but he tries to show that ultimately difficult situations, if we rely on God, are in our favor, not the favor of those who oppress. The farmer is an example. The farmer is dependent upon God for rain. But if the farmer is going to truly have a crop, the farmer has to be patient and wait on the rain. Sometimes we wait on it not to rain, right? Especially this year. But the farmer has to be patient to wait on the rain. But if the farmer just sits back and twiddles his thumbs, what's going to happen to the crop? Even if it gets sufficient rain, what's going to happen? It's not going to work. It's not going to be harvested right. Not only that, there's something called a weed that's going to take over, right? So the farmer, while he's patient and waiting for the crop to grow and waiting for the rains, still has to be busy about doing positive things to try and overcome the lack of rainfall or too much rain. So we're not, he's saying here, while you're to be patient, you're not to be totally passive, but to act carefully with the heart and the mind. To act carefully with the heart and the mind. Strengthening your hearts for the coming of the Lord is near. James, we've seen that he's talked about suffering and adversity as a means for strengthening. It's even more so in Hebrews. But James says that too. And here he's saying that these things that are happening, you also must be patient and strengthen your hearts during this time. Seeking riches is not what you're about doing. Seeking riches is in vain, but those who wait patiently will be rewarded. But patience demands courage, does it not? Patience, this kind of patience, demands courage. It takes more fortitude and more courage not to retaliate than it does to retaliate. He doesn't say it, but I would think if anybody was being unjustly oppressed and if anybody had a right to retaliate, that fella that said, "Father, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing," had a right. And he's one that could have retaliated in ways that we can't. And yet in the middle of all of that injustice, Jesus courageously prayed for the ones killing him. And then he promised the one of those that had been an oppressor in other ways, who was dying beside him, because he stood up for Jesus, that he'd have a place in paradise. When he could have turned and looked at him and said, "I'm going to tell you where you can go right now because you deserve to be here." But he didn't. He said, "I'm going to tell you where you can go, and you can go to paradise because you had the courage to stand up." And so this kind of patience demands courage and demands strength. When he says strengthening your heart for the coming of the Lord is near, he's talking about in order for us to act this way, we have to be strong.
I have a teacher that is blatant about what she says and how she responds, and she just automatically lets her mouth go
right. Whenever
somebody does something that doesn't suit her. In 5 minutes, she's hugging that person. But that person will come to me, you know, and
right. Right.
For years.
Yeah.
For that whatever it was, it might have been minor.
Yeah. And that's where actually the weakness is when the person in the school building tries for years to retaliate and build up and find ways to dig here and to dig there. And that doesn't take courage. And that doesn't take strength. In fact, that's a weakness. We are weak when we give in to that kind of temptation to retaliate. But you see it, and my bride sees the results of it now more than she ever did before. That is a difficult kind of thing. It takes courage, and courage takes strength. Strength to do what's right. It doesn't take strength to do what's wrong. I think that's hard when you know the person and you forgive them and you have the courage and the strength to be patient and they come back and they come back and they come back. Of course, it also, Jesus says to turn the other cheek, but he doesn't say what happens when you run out of cheeks. So you got a decision there. You can either retaliate or you can remove yourself from the situation, if at all possible. Now, sometimes you can't. Sometimes you're working in the same building with the person, but you can confront them in an appropriate way, verbally, and if they blow a gasket, you just do what you can to do your work in a positive way and be a positive example. And that, once again, that takes strength and that takes courage, and that's the hard thing to do. But you don't have to be a doormat. You don't have to continually put yourself in the way. And if you continue to put yourself in the way so that other people start feeling sorry for you, what have you done? Well, you have retaliated in a passive-aggressive way, and you've retaliated in a way by you have chosen to play the martyr so that now everybody feels sorry for you. And so, in a way, you have retaliated, but you're also not only retaliating, but you're using that to build yourself up rather than remaining where you are and living your life in a proper sense of humility. Yeah, it is. These guys don't say easy things. We sanitize them in church a lot of times. They don't say easy things. And James is talking to people that are, they're being persecuted by all kinds of folks outside the church. Not only that, they're being persecuted by these folks in the church who take advantage of them and who don't seem to care. Beloved, do not grumble against one another, so that you may not be judged. See, the judge is standing at the door. Not grumbling is a statement against speaking evil about those members of the community of faith. He's not saying, oh boy, this is really horrible. Boy, I wish they'd learn. What he's talking about here is do not judge and then go out and speak evil against them. That in itself is retaliation. To go out and start talking evil against them in all kinds of other places, that's retaliation. And he said, in your own way, you're doing exactly what they were doing to you. And I've heard it so many times, although sometimes I think, two wrongs don't make a right. Oftentimes, two wrongs just make it worse. He says, do not utter judgments against those church members or condemn them, or you yourself will be judged by the same. Seems to me somebody said something somewhere about judge not that you not be judged also, for the judgment that you use is the same judgment that will be put back to you. Or as my sons, I've told you before, as my sons used to say, one at me, three at you. And you point a finger. Now be careful. Don't do that because it will come back. The judge is standing at the doors, and he will judge not only those folks who have oppressed, but if you retaliate, you will be judged likewise. That's hard stuff. I don't want to always stand by. And especially if it's somebody I really care about that got hurt. I don't always want to stand by. And then he says, look at the prophets and Job. As an example of suffering and patience, beloved, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Indeed, we call blessed those who showed endurance. And you have heard of the endurance of Job, and you've seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. The word here, as they suffered and endured, Indeed, we call blessed those who showed endurance. The word is makrothumia in Greek, which means they were long-suffering. It's also a synonym for persistence and perseverance. But it implies containing yourself while waiting for an event that is to come. Containing yourself while waiting for that event. Controlling yourself, persevering. And really, retaliation is a lack of control, is it not? It's a lack of control. Even if you sit down and plan it out, it's still a lack of control. Sometimes you plan it out in your head, and then once you plan it out in your head and you think about it, then you don't actually do it. I had somebody tell me one time, one of the best things to do is just go out and start throwing eggs at a tree. That can get expensive. Yeah. He's not talking about disengagement. He's talking about patient and appropriate response to injustice. He says, Job is an example of personal integrity with truthful speech. Job refused to accept blame for what he suffered. And he did insist on vindication, did he not? Of course, Job didn't carry it out. He kept calling on God to vindicate. And he survived his ordeal, bloodied and unbowed, except for God. In fact, Christopher Church writes, Job even played the part of peacemaker, offering sacrifices for his comforters. Remember those guys that came supposedly to comfort him, but all they really did was ran him down and said, well, you sinned and you got to do this and you got to do that. So Job's response, he repaid his comforters with kindness. Pray for those who persecute you. For in so doing, you will heap coals of fire. Oh boy, I'll heap coals of fire on their heads. But James uses Job as that one who was long-suffering. But notice what he says. And this is really the emphasis for James. If you don't retaliate, if we are long-suffering, if we work not to retaliate, the point is here. And you have seen the purposes of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. Compassionate and merciful to whom? The ones who were oppressed and did not retaliate. James sees Job's story as a story about God's compassion and mercy on someone who was suffering unjustly. And he says that same God is for the oppressed and will reward those who patiently endure. Now, does that make me not want to retaliate sometimes? No. Yeah. That's right, Melissa. It is a test. And how we respond to those situations ultimately determines what will happen. But it's a test of our faith in God and what we say about God. We say God is merciful, God's compassionate, God is loving, God will help us through everything. And then we get to those points where we say, okay, God, where are you? If you don't do something, I'm going to. And it's in those moments, James says, the easy thing is to retaliate. The hard thing is to say, Father, forgive them. And the harder thing is to say, wish I could do this more often. But the harder thing than saying, Father, forgive them, is, and I'm going to forgive them too. That's the ideal. I would lie to you if you told you that I portray the ideal. I wouldn't even say I'd lie to you if I told you I portray it all the time. I'd be lying to you if I told you I portrayed it half the time, or maybe even less. Because in your mind, even if you don't actually reach out and touch in your mind, and that which is in the mind and the heart, I know and I know the feelings that I have for some folks, that out of that sense of anguish, hurting family, still eat at me. And they're not hurting that person because they're out there doing whatever. And that's the hard part, because it's not hurting that person, it's hurting me. Yes. Yeah, I wish he had gotten a job. Yes, you have a question about Job, and I don't guarantee an answer, but we'll see. That's what the Satan said, and that's what God said. Whatever you need to do to test him, but you can't accept the killing.
So you have Job, then you have his family members at that time who were lives of the same value as Job.
Right.
And they did die.
They did die.
I've never understood. What about family? What about those individuals?
I wish I had a real good answer. Job is an epic poem about a number of things, and the main question that is asked is, why do bad things happen to good people, and why doesn't God step in and supernaturally intervene in every situation? Yeah, we will face that. And Job's, I've heard people try to say, well, God knew that he was going to restore Job's family, and God rewarded those other family, even though the Satan took them, and God rewarded them and gave them a special place in paradise, and that's just somebody's pipe dream to say that, because I really don't know.
I heard it said one time that, Job always made a sacrifice for his children, and that's why he took all the animals first.
Right. Yeah. Well, I've heard that as well, and I still don't know that plays. Job is an epic poem about why do bad things, and ask that question, why do bad things happen to good people? And if God is good, and if God is loving, then why didn't God intervene there? And I really don't know. Oh, yeah. Yes, that's there are folks. There are folks that. Yeah, there are a lot of folks over the centuries that have said, it's really more of a parable. Of course, I sometimes use it just to muddy the waters a little more, not answering your question here. People are constantly saying, well, the devil was in the serpent in the garden. He had already been cast out and was there. Well, the thing is, in the book of Job, the devil hadn't been cast out yet, and the devil gets to go to and fro back and forth into the heavenly court. And there are already people on the earth. For the writer of Genesis 1 and 2, Genesis 2 and following, the devil wasn't in the serpent. It was a temptation that took place. But the devil wasn't in the serpent. So trying to see it how they wrote it. But sometimes I'll play that little advocate and say, well, wait a minute. I thought the devil was in this. Well, he wasn't a serpent. So he was kicked out? Sure. Well, then how come he gets to go right into God back and forth in the book of Job? And he's not, I really don't know how we justify and rectify that, other than the fact that for some reason, what was done, God used it for a good purpose. But as far as the lives of those who died, I don't know that they were any more or less important than Job. But then again, sometimes we choose to do things that end up causing harm and heartache that God gets a blame for when God didn't do it because of our free choice. God watched and God allowed it to happen, and then God can try and take that and use it on the other side. But as far as Job, the places fell in, but we really don't know what his children were doing that might have, decisions they made that might have contributed to it. Or anything else. Well, that's true. I mean, we're not promised the next we're not promised to survive the next sneeze, you know, when our heart stops and has to pick up again. I mean, we can do all kinds of things, and I've done plenty of studies on the book of Job, but that question still comes around, and I don't have an adequate answer. I wish I did, as to why their lives seem to be any less valuable. And I don't know that ultimately they were, but to us it seems that way. And then Job gets blamed for everything by his friends, quote unquote friends and comforters. And his wife even says, "Why don't you go ahead and curse God and die? Because obviously you've done something to bring this on. You did this to me. You know, you've done something to bring this on the family and upon all of us." And Job said, "No, I hadn't. I just tried to be faithful." But in the end, the emphasis is upon God's sovereignty, and Job had a relationship or a faith in God, a relationship with God, where he didn't mind asking questions. But then again, if God's God, God's bigger than our questions. God can handle any question we ask. The key is that ultimately Job had to listen to the answer and listen for the answer. And was rewarded. Do I think Job ever forgot those others? No more than David forgetting that child born of he and Bathsheba that died at 7 days old, wasn't even allowed to be circumcised and be a child of Abraham. And David says, "I can go to Sheol to him, but he can never return to me." Or Joseph, after all those years, when the sons come back and they tell Jacob or Israel, said, "Well, guess what? You know, this guy we've been talking about has been so many. It's really Joseph, because you see, we lied to you all those years ago, and the dad passed out when he saw all the stuff, and said, 'Oh no, we killed it.' No. But then he comes back around, and what's the first thing he says after all those years? It's enough. I can now die a happy death because my son's alive. I'll go see him, and I can die a happy man." So, you know, I don't think Job forgot them any more than Jacob forgot Joseph after all those years when he had all these other sons, or that David forgot that first son of he and Bathsheba who died. But I don't know. That's one of those I don't have an answer for. Just possibilities. If y'all got an answer to that, please. Well, it's 1 minute after 7. Do what? Well, I look forward to seeing you again. God bless you. Thank you. Amen.